After another immense span of time, we read, Yima was summoned to a meeting place by the good river Daicha, where the god Ahura Mazda appeared to him, bearing an ominous warning of sudden and catastrophic climate change. O fair Yima, upon the material world the fatal winters are going to fall, that shall bring the fierce, foul frost. Upon the material world, the fatal winters are going to fall, that shall make snowflakes fall thick, even on the highest tops of mountains. Therefore make thee a vara, a hypogeum or underground enclosure, long as a riding ground on every side of the square. And thither bring the seeds of sheep and oxen, of men, of dogs, of birds, and of red blazing fires. Thither thou shalt bring the seeds of men and women of the greatest, best, and finest kinds on this earth. Thither shalt thou bring the seeds of every kind of cattle, of the greatest, best, and finest kinds on this earth. Thither shalt thou bring the seeds of every kind of tree, of the greatest, best, and finest kinds on this earth. Thither shalt thou bring the seeds of every kind of fruit, the fullest of food and the sweetest of odor. All those seeds shalt thou bring, two of every kind, to be kept inexhaustible there, so long as those men shall stay in the vara. There shall be no hump-backed, none bulged forward there, no impotent, no lunatic, no leprous. So, you get the idea, this underground hideaway was to serve as a refuge from a terrible winter that was about to seize Airyana Vallejo, a winter at the onset of which, as the Bundahish, another Zoroastrian text, informs us, the evil spirit sprang like a snake out of the sky down to the earth. He rushed in at noon, and thereby the sky was as shattered and frightened by him as a sheep by a wolf. He came onto the water which was arranged below the earth, and then the middle of this earth was pierced and entered by him. He rushed out upon the whole creation, and he made the world quite as injured and dark at midday as though it were dark night. Studying these accounts, I couldn't help but be reminded of the 2 millennia of warm, fine weather which must indeed have seemed like a golden age, before the sudden, lethal onset of the Younger Dryas 12,800 years ago. The Zoroastrian texts would not be far wrong in describing it as a fierce, foul frost, and as a fatal winter. The evil spirit to whom this affliction is attributed is Angra Mainyu, the agent of darkness, destruction, wickedness, and chaos, who stands in opposition to and seeks to undermine and undo all the good works of Ahura Mazda. For Zoroastrianism is a profoundly dualistic religion, in which human beings and the choices we make for good or evil are seen as the objects of an eternal competition or contest between the opposed forces of darkness and light. And in this contest, the darkness sometimes wins. Thus the Vendidad reminds us that although Airyana Vallejo was the first of the good lands and countries created by Ahura Mazda, it could not resist the evil one. Thereupon came Angra Mainyu, who is all death, and he counter-created by his witchcraft the serpent in the river, and winter, a work of the demons. Now there are 10 winter months there, 2 summer months, and these are cold for the waters, cold for the earth, cold for the trees. Winter falls there, with the worst of its plagues. In other translations, the phrase the serpent in the river and winter is given as a great serpent and winter, and alternatively as a mighty serpent and snow. Again, you get the idea. The metaphor that is being repeatedly driven home here is that of the mighty serpent who springs from the sky down to the earth, who penetrates the earth, and who brings a prolonged winter upon the world, so severe that it is dark, most turbid, opaque, according to some translations, at midday, and even the fleeting summer months are too cold for human life. Once again, the whole scenario seems very accurately to describe the terrible conditions that would have afflicted the world after the Younger Dryas comet spread its trail of destruction across at least 50 million square kilometers, brought on a vehement destroying frost, and threw such quantities of dust into the upper atmosphere, together with smoke from the continent-wide wildfires sparked off by airbursts and superheated ejecta, that a turbid, opaque darkness would indeed have filled the skies, reflecting back the sun's rays and perpetuating something very like a nuclear winter for centuries. The Zoroastrian texts leave us in no doubt that these conditions posed a deadly threat to the future survival of civilization. It was for this reason that Ahura Mazda came to Yima with his warning and his instruction to build an underground shelter where some remnant of humanity could take refuge, keeping safe the seeds of all animals and plants until the dire winter had passed and spring returned to the world. Moreover, the account reveals very little that seems mythical or that obviously derives from flights of religious fancy. Rather, the whole thing has about it an atmosphere of hard-headed, practical planning that adds a chilling note of veracity. For example, the admonition that deformed, impotent, lunatic, and leprous people should be kept out of the Vara sounds a lot like eugenics, a distasteful policy to be sure, but one that might be implemented if the survival of the human race was at stake and there was limited space available in the refuge. For the same reasons, it's not surprising that only the seeds of the greatest, best, and finest kinds of trees, fruits, and vegetables, those that are fullest of food and sweetest of odor, are to be brought to the Vara. Why waste space on anything but the best? Also, although it is certain that a number of carefully selected people were to be admitted to the Vara, perhaps as caretakers and managers of the project and as future breeding stock, the emphasis throughout is on seeds, which in the case of human beings would be sperm from the males and eggs from the females. So when we read that the Vara is to be constructed in three subterranean levels, each smaller than the one above, each with its own system of crisscrossing streets, it is legitimate to wonder whether some kind of storage system, perhaps with ranks of shelves arranged in crisscrossing aisles, might not really be what is meant here. In the largest part of the place, thou shalt make 9 streets, 6 in the middle part, 3 in the smallest. To the streets of the largest part, thou shalt bring 1,000 seeds of men and women. To the streets of the middle part, 600. To the streets of the smallest part, 300. If it seems fanciful to imagine that we might, in an almost high-tech sense, be looking at the specifications of a seed bank here, then how are we to assess other technological aspects of the Vara, for example, its lighting system? As well as making a door to the place and sealing it up with the golden ring already given to him by Ahura Mazda, Yima is also to fashion a window, self-shining within. When Yima asks for clarification as to the nature of this self-shining window, Ahura Mazda tells him cryptically, there are uncreated lights and created lights. The former are the stars, the moon, and the sun, which will not be seen from within the confines of the Vara during the long winter, but the latter are artificial lights, which shine from below. Yima did as he was instructed, and completed the Vara, which thereafter glowed with its own light. That accomplished, he then made waters flow in a bed a mile long. There he settled birds by the evergreen banks that bear never-failing food. There he established dwelling places consisting of a house with a balcony, a courtyard, and a gallery. There too, we're reminded, in accord with the commands of the god, he brought the seeds of men and women. There he brought the seeds of every kind of tree and every kind of fruit. All those seeds he brought, 2 of every kind, to be kept inexhaustible there, so long as those men shall stay in the Vara. Finally, we learn that every 40th year, to every couple, 2 are born, a male and a female, and thus it is for every sort of cattle, and the men in the Vara which Yima made live the happiest life. Interestingly, the translator explains in a footnote drawn from various ancient learned commentaries on the text that the human inhabitants of the Vara live there for 150 years. Some say they never die. Moreover, and particularly intriguing, the births of offspring to every couple do not result from sexual union, but from the seeds deposited in the Vara. Other hints of a mysterious lost technology connected to Yima include a miraculous cup in which he could see everything that was happening anywhere in the world, and a jeweled glass throne, sometimes described as a glass chariot, that was capable of flight. Flood and rain. As well as a climate catastrophe, in the form of an overnight reversion to peak ice age cold, we also know that the Younger Dryas involved extensive global flooding as a large fraction of the North American ice cap melted and poured into the world ocean. It is therefore noteworthy that the Zoroastrian texts speak not only of the vehement destroying frost of a global winter, but also of an associated flood accompanied by heavy precipitation in which every single drop of rain became as big as a bowl, and the water stood the height of a man over the whole of this earth. On the other side of the world, and much closer to the North American epicenter of the cataclysm, the Popol Vuh, an original document of the ancient Quiche Maya of Guatemala, based on pre-conquest sources, also speaks of a flood, and associates it with much hail, black rain and mist, and indescribable cold. It says, in a remarkable echo of the Zoroastrian tradition, that this was a period when it was cloudy and twilight all over the world. The faces of the sun and the moon were covered. Other Maya sources confirm that these strange and terrible phenomena were experienced by mankind in the time of the ancients. The earth darkened. It happened that the sun was still bright and clear. Then at midday it got dark. Sunlight was not seen again until the 26th year after the flood. Returning to the Middle East, the famous account of the Hebrew patriarch Noah and the great ark in which he rides out the flood commands attention. It's obvious that there are many parallels with the story of Yima and his Vara. The Vara, after all, is a means of surviving a terrible and devastating winter, which will destroy every living creature by enchaining the earth in a freezing trap of ice and snow. The ark, likewise, is a means of surviving a terrible and devastating flood, which will destroy every living creature by drowning the world in water. In both cases, a deity, Ahura Mazda in the case of the Zoroastrian tradition, the god Yahweh in the case of the Hebrew tradition, intervenes to give advance warning to a good and pure man to prepare for the coming cataclysm. In each case, the essence of the project is to preserve the seeds, or the breeding pairs, of all life. And of every living thing, of all flesh, two of every sort shalt thou bring into the ark to keep them alive with thee. They shall be male and female. Of fowls after their kind, and of cattle after their kind, of every creeping thing of the earth after his kind, two of every sort shall come unto thee to keep them alive. Easily missed but noteworthy is the fact that Noah's ark, like Yima's Vara, is to have a window, is to be closed with a door, and is to consist of three levels. A window shalt thou make to the ark, and in a cubit shalt thou finish it above, and the door of the ark shalt thou set in the side thereof, with lower, second, and third stories shalt thou make it. Last but not least, there are hints of a lost lighting technology in Noah's ark that parallel the references to the artificial lights in the Vara. In The Legends of the Jews, Lewis Ginsberg's remarkable and comprehensive compilation of ancient stories and traditions connected to the Hebrew Bible, we read that the whole journey of the ark during the year of the flood was conducted in darkness both by day and by night. All the time it lasted, the sun and the moon shed no light. However, just like the self-shining window of the Vara, the ark was illuminated by a precious stone, the light of which was more brilliant by night than by day, so enabling Noah to distinguish between day and night. Underground cities. Noah's ark, as is well known, is said to have ended its journey on the slopes of Mount Ararat, the symbolic heartland of ancient Armenia, but now, as a result of wars in the early 20th century, located within the modern state of Turkey. Turkey, in turn, shares a border with Iran, ancient Persia, from which the accounts of Yima's Vara come down to us. It is therefore intriguing that Turkey's Cappadocia region has a very large number of ancient underground structures hewn out of solid rock and usually, like the Vara, consisting of multiple levels stacked one above the other. These underground cities, as they're known, include the eerie and spectacular site of Derinkuyu, which I was able to visit in 2013. Lying beneath a modern town of the same name, 8 of its levels are presently open to the public, although further levels remain closed off below, and astonishingly, a subterranean tunnel several kilometers in length connects it to another, similar hypogeum at Kaymakli. Entering Derinkuyu was like crossing some invisible barrier into an unexpected netherworld. 1 minute I was standing in bright sunshine, the next after I had ducked into the cool, dank, dimly lit system of tunnels and galleries, no self-shining windows now, only low wattage electric light, I felt I had been transported to a realm carved out by mythical dwarves at the dawn of time. In places, the tunnels are low and narrow, so that one must stoop and walk in single file between walls stained and blackened with ancient smoke and overgrown here and there with green mold. At regular intervals, slid back into deep recesses, I passed hulking megalithic doors, shaped like millstones, 5 to 6 feet, 1.5 to 1.8 meters in diameter, and weighing close to half a ton. These were clearly designed to be rolled out to block access. Stairways and steep ramps led down from level to level, and although all the levels were interconnected, the rolling stone doors could be used to isolate them from one another when needed. I noticed a remarkable system of plunging, sheer-sided ventilation shafts connecting the deepest levels with the surface, and doing so to such good effect that the gusts of fresh air were still palpable 80 meters, 260 feet or more beneath the ground. In some places, the passageway I was following would debouch into a junction where tunnels branched off in several directions and more stairways led down to even lower levels. And here and there, now to one side of the passageway, now to the other, sometimes accessed by means of holes cut in the wall, sometimes through full-sized doorways, lay small, low-ceilinged grottos, in which even a few people sitting together would have felt cramped. But sometimes those doors would lead into interconnected networks of chambers and passages, and sometimes they would open out suddenly into lofty halls and spacious rooms with barrel vault ceilings looming high overhead, supported on monolithic columns hewn from the living rock. The whole place, in short, is a complex and cunning labyrinth on an immense scale, a work of astonishing architectural complexity that would be impressive if it had been built above ground, but that is utterly breathtaking when one considers that it all had to be mined, chiseled, hammered, cut, and gouged out of the volcanic bedrock. Later, studying a plan, I realized that this vast hypogeum, looking in cross-section like a gigantic rabbit warren and extending over an area of more than 4 square kilometers, lay underfoot wherever one went in the modern town of Derinkuyu, streets beneath streets, rooms beneath rooms, a secret, antipodal city of unknown antiquity and of unknown purpose, but certainly the product of immense ingenuity, determination, and skill. And Derinkuyu is just one of 200 such subterranean complexes, each containing a minimum of 2 levels, with around 40 containing 3 levels or more, that have been identified in Turkey in the area between Kayseri and Nevşehir. Moreover, new discoveries are constantly being made. Derinkuyu itself was found in 1963 after builders renovating the cellar of a modern home broke through to an ancient passageway below. And most recently, in 2014, workers preparing the ground for a new housing project at Nevşehir, an hour's drive north of Derinkuyu, stumbled upon yet another unsuspected hypogeum. Archaeologists were called in, and it was quickly realized that this one was bigger than any of the others so far known. As Hasan Unver, mayor of Nevşehir, put it, Derinkuyu and Kaymakli are little more than kitchens when compared to the newly explored site. It is not a known underground city, added Mehmet Ergun Turan, head of Turkey's Housing Development Administration. Tunnel passages of 7 kilometers are being discussed. Naturally, when the discovery was made, we stopped the construction we were planning to do in the area. Several commentators immediately speculated